Welcome to another edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides this October 1st morning, 11 to 1:30. I'll be with you. First up on deck is going to be a report from a Vicious Vinny, the V-Man, who's taking time out from his own show to give us an update on what's going on with free radio across the country and the most recent machinations in Congress, a protest against the National Association of Broadcasters. Everything you wanted to know or afraid to ask, didn't know where to look. That's going to be coming up shortly. Also, we're going to be reviewing the NAACP pseudo-forum for the city council candidates. It happened last Wednesday. Hope to have commentator Scott Graham in talking about the city council. Stay with us.
Of Rockefeller, Campanella, Communist Bloc. Roy Khan, one for all, Tuscanini, Dacron, Gin, Gin, Foo Falls, rock around the clock. Einstein, James Dean, Brooklyn's got a winning team. Davy Crockett, Peter Pan, Elvis Presley, Disneyland, Bardo, Budapest, Alabama, Khrushchev, Prince's Great, Cakey Place, Trouble in the Suez.
We didn't start the fire.
Welcome again to the Sunday edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. I'm your ever-loving host, Uncle Robert, a.k.a. Robert Norse, and with me in the studio is another ever-loving talk show host here. I'm not sure how much of a talk show or talk-at-you show it is. That's Vicious Vinny, the V-Man. Hey, Vinny.
Good morning.
Ooh, sorry about that. Say that again.
Good morning.
All righty. Here's a story I'm going to read to you, Vinny. I'm going to ask for your thoughts on it and also some updates, because I know you've been following closely Free Radio. I guess you were up in San Francisco and have been carrying that reports from that on your show.
Yes, the National Association of Broadcasters, which met last week.
National Association of Bullies, Bad Boys, and Boo-Boo Heads, that sort of thing.
And Brainwashers.
Here's a story called Cranking Up State Repression Raid on Human Rights Radio. Human Rights Radio in Springfield, Illinois, has been shut down by the feds. An email sent out several days ago by longtime station supporter Mike Townsend indicates that the station was raided at 5:15 by a multi-jurisdictional task force consisting of federal marshals, sheriff's deputies, city police, and FCC agents. The task force ransacked the station, taking broadcast equipment and a computer. They took the transmitter, a mixer board, microphones, CD players, tape players, some speakers. They had a two-page list, Townsend told San Francisco Liberation Radio in a phone interview several days ago. They even took his computer. This action comes just as news reaches us that half of the U.S. Senate is now signed on to a bill introduced by Senator Rod Grams, Republican of Minnesota, to overturn the FCC's decision legalizing micro-radio or low-power FM. Grams' bill is a replica of the notorious Oxley bill, which passed the House on April 13th. Both bills will reduce by 80% the number of low-power FM stations which can be licensed and will require a new round of technical tests that many view as a ruse designed to keep low-power stations off the air permanently. Human Rights Radio in Springfield was founded by Mabana Kantako, considering... Do I have that pronounced right there?
Yeah, Mabana.
Considered the father of micro radio movement, Kantako, a blind African American, put the station on the air in 1987 and used the public airwaves to discuss police brutality in the community. This new level of state repression comes in the wake of 4 days of successful in-your-face protests against the NAB, National Association of Broadcasters, last week in San Francisco. The NAB in the past week has mounted what has been described as a full-court press lobbying effort in support of the Grams bill, which it is expected will be attached as a rider to a budget appropriations bill so as to reduce the chance chances of a presidential veto. The raid in Springfield came after a court hearing earlier in the day in which a federal judge issued a temporary restraining order against the station, Townsend said. A second hearing in which Kantako is expected to represent himself is scheduled for next Wednesday. He, Kantako, went down to the courtroom on Friday morning, said Townsend. They already had all the orders typed up and everything for the judge to sign. Townsend said FCC agent Will Gray was paid visits and sent threatening letters to the station for years, was present in the courtroom. Gray works out of the Chicago FCC field office. The whole thing was this trumped-up deal. I mean, it was no surprise was that the station was supposedly interfering with air traffic, and they had a lot of pilots, a log of pilots, who supposedly said they had heard this, that, or the other thing. One of them said he thought he heard kazoo music, Townsend said. The FCC and the NEB have long raised the specter of air traffic interference as a reason for outlawing low-power FM. It doesn't carry much weight around here because Mabana has been on the air 4,448 days and nights, Townsend said. He added, the other thing is it just so happens that this weekend is when they have the big Springfield Air Show. The U.S. Air Force Thunderbirds are going to be here and everything. I think they thought that if anybody gets concerned about this, we'll just tell them he was endangering thousands of lives, and we had to do it. Vinny, free radio has been on the air for 5 years here in Santa Cruz, but California has been relatively free of these kinds of raids, although there have been a few. You want to? What are our chances here at free radio?
Really hard to say, Robert, honestly. Anyone's guess, really, because it's weird. It seems that in other parts of the country, they do these, you know, military-style raids where they put people at gunpoint. This has happened in Florida, now in Springfield, the latest that we just heard about on Friday afternoon. So it's really hard to say. There haven't been any seizures like that in California, as far as I know. The only thing that they have done is go after people in court. They have threatened people and confiscated equipment that way by intimidation tactics, but we haven't seen this kind of raid here in California yet, so anyone's guess.
So you were up in San Francisco a week ago, and you no doubt gave quite an analysis, probably an on-the-spot airing of the actual tapes you had from that period, right?
Mm-hmm.
You want to just, for those of us who weren't able to follow your show or just can't seem to get the common sense to know when it is, which it is, of course, on
Wednesday evenings at 9 p.m., 9 to midnight, Rockin' the Boat.
Rockin' the Boat. I should write that on my forehand or my forehead or my forepaw or something, my forelock. Can you summarize how things went up there?
I was disappointed with the turnout. However, it was good to see, you know, even just a couple hundred people voicing their concerns about media consolidation and putting forth positive ways of taking back the air and confronting the corporations that control the media currently.
I understand that some attorneys were actually arrested, though the actual protesters sat on the steps without interference.
Yeah, what happened is on Wednesday the 20th, the NAB started their little shindig, their Radio 2000 convention, and there was a protest out in front of the Moscone Center where it was being held. The protest was by the National Organization of Women, NOW, and that started off the event. I wasn't there until Wednesday evening, and there wasn't really much going on Wednesday night. Thursday, we went down to Moscone Center early in the morning, and there was sort of a press conference being held by the Billionaires for More Media Consolidation, a subsidiary of the Billionaires for Bush or Gore.
I love that Billionaires group, man. They're all dressed up in their top hats and their silk suits.
Yeah, they're pretty funny.
They are unashamed, man.
And so they held this like mock press conference, and they called it the National Association of Brainwashers. Anyhow, that went on Thursday morning. There was no real civil disobedient direct action type things going on Thursday.
Was there a big police turnout? I know in L.A., of course, you couldn't get around because there were so many police. But
there wasn't, really. There was a few cops on hand, but it was largely a quiet event for the most part. It was a minor inconvenience for the NAB on Thursday. Thursday afternoon, Stephen Dunifer held workshops all day at his facilities in Berkeley.
And Stephen Dunifer, should be said, is sort of one of the pioneers in free radio who began producing or making available a kind of a cheap kit in 1993 so folks could set up their own stations, and he indeed was one of the founders of Free Radio Berkeley, right?
That's correct. And he was giving workshops for people interested in learning how to build their own equipment, and he went through that step by step.
Has that changed in the last 7 years?
Well, the technology's always changing. They're always working on modifying making it easier and cheaper and smaller.
So if students wanted to set up their own station, let's say on the Hill, how much would it cost them?
Now, it depends on how many watts you want, but for a basic 15-watt kit, you're looking at maybe $750 for the basic package of a transmitter, coaxial cable, a small mixing board, and an antenna.
So really, it's a relatively small investment for a collective. It's a very small investment.
Yeah, definitely. Under $1,000.
Do you see in the last few years an increase in the number of stations sprouting up across the country, or should we say a plateauing or a decline? What do you see?
Wow. It's really hard to gauge. There haven't been too many raids from what I've been following. But, stations are always coming on the air and hopefully staying on the air. That's the important thing, that stations that do come online and go on, stay on, and not be intimidated by the FCC.
I know that one of the reasons that the collective, the Free Radio Santa Cruz Collective, has been so clear about its own commitment to a very particular form of free speech, which doesn't involve, for example, hate speech or discriminatory speech, is that the low cost of free power broadcasting means the Klan, the Nazis, any groups that want, church groups, the city council, can get their own station for a very relatively small amount of money. So it's not a question of censorship within the collective. It's more a function of, if you want to put out a kind of series of programs, you don't have to come to one monopoly broadcaster, one person. There isn't one company store. There is, in fact, you can start your own. And I guess what surprised me is that there's been relatively few stations started in the last few years. I mean, in terms of, we heard of a kind of a booming number of stations, and there were national conventions of free radio station people. But I haven't heard that it's really been escalating, although I guess there have been a lot of requests for these bandwidths that were going to be legal, were going to be coming out spots on the FM dial for micropower, although that micropower was cut down by even the proposed House bill, the FCC bill, which would have only allowed, which essentially would have made it illegal to start a station in a big city because they have this second adjacent channel rule, which gives an unnecessarily broad range of, quote, protection to existing FM stations. At the last national convention you were at, Vinny, or heard about, had the number of stations been increasing? I haven't been aware that there has been much of an increase in the last few years. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, again, it's hard to say because sometimes stations that do come online don't want to go public. They want to try and keep a veneer of, a shadowy kind of underground presence, and they don't really come out publicly with statements on the internet or statements to the corporate press. So, I mean, I think that it's a vibrant movement. There are stations all over the nation in different parts of the country, different cities. And the important thing, again, is to, once you're online, stay online and don't be intimidated by the FCC.
By online, you mean on the air?
On the air, yeah.
On the air.
Because
I know that there was some talk about, gosh, you micropower people don't have to worry about going on the air. You can just do it on the
internet.
On
yeah.
the internet. Now, what's wrong with that, Vinny?
Well, it's been said before, but who really owns a computer? I mean, why are we're doing this to reach people that are left out of the media, the lower class, poor folks that are the majority of people in the world, and we're trying to get through with our messages that are left out of mainstream media. And who owns computers? I mean, look at who owns computers, really. I mean, if we're trying to reach, homeless people like you on the streets to give them information they need, or just your average working class folk, most of those folks aren't, able to sit on a computer 24 hours a day and listen to internet radio. I mean, everybody owns a radio station. It's one of the cheapest forms of media around, and it's largely considered a free service because you just buy your radio and you tune in, and then you got, you don't have to spend 50 cents a day for the paper. You don't have to spend thousands and thousands of dollars to get the latest, G3 Mac computer or whatever the latest top-of-the-line computer is that runs audio. I mean, to run a computer with audio, it's a pretty expensive endeavor. that you're talking about. So
now, free radio does go out on the internet right now. In fact, it's streaming at the moment. Is that
yes,
accurate?
We are.
So if you do want to check it out on your computer, all you rich listeners or computer savvy listeners, it's at www.microradio.net/frsc. Is that a forward slash or a backslash?
I think that's a backslash. I don't know though. I get confused.
Yeah, it's a slash. So try it both ways if you want to.
It's the one in the lower right corner. The same one as the question mark key.
Be a slasher.
Yeah.
But in Santa Cruz, there hasn't been another free radio station that's actually started in the last 7 years since free radio has been around, has there?
Not in the city limits. There was Radio Watson at 96.3, frequency of change for the Pajaro Valley. And they were on the air for about 3 years, I believe, before they caved into pressure from the FCC, unfortunately, and took their equipment off the air back in about 2 years ago, in 1998, in October of 98. And there was talk of a possible station up in San Lorenzo Valley. I think they did some preliminary testing, and I don't think it went further than that. There was also a rumor that there was a station in Capitola. I never was able to pick it up. It was allegedly broadcasting, I believe, at 90.7 or something. Romito, programmer here, who's a blind programmer, tuned it in, and he said it was an unlicensed station. But
takes the ears of the blind to hear it, I guess.
Yeah, I guess he's got that extra sensory perception there with his hearing. I was not unable to confirm any other stations in Santa Cruz County other than those.
Well, it's interesting. There are lots of students, and I assume some of them with significant amounts of money. I suggest students listening to this show, possibly Jake Fathy, Jacob Oltham, candidates who are running could do actually set up their own radio station and not just broadcast before the election in order to get the vote and to get out the issues, but after the election to the student community to mobilize people to come to city council, to come down and support important causes like the incredible waste and loss of ruining of lives around the drug war that happens here in Santa Cruz as it does across the country. This man who was taken, whose station was shut down, Human Rights Radio, I guess his name is Kantako,
yeah.
Mabana Kantako.
Mabana Kantako.
Is there much solidarity? Are people kind of getting together to say, hey, let's stop this? What kind of outrageous behavior? Is there we've seen a lot about a Mumia support movement. What about a Mabana Kantako support movement? Is
well,
anything
I certainly hope so. I would definitely push for that. And I will do what I can to raise funds and help him get back on the air. He's a hero of mine, honestly. He is credited with, starting this whole radio, micro power radio movement back in 1987, the longest running unlicensed station to date, and it's a real damn shame what they did to him on Friday afternoon by taking his equipment. Here's a man that's been working in the community, helping out the children, getting them on the right path in life, and using the airwaves to educate and inform his community in Springfield, Illinois, which is a largely African American community. They're facing a lot of serious police repression over there, and what he's been doing is a wonderful thing, and it's a damn shame. In fact, I spoke with him yesterday afternoon, lengthy interview, in fact, about a half an hour we talked.
Will you be broadcasting that?
Yeah, I played it yesterday, the unedited clips. I'm working on editing it as we speak, and I will be re-airing that again on Wednesday evening at 9 o'clock, Rockin' the Boat. But it's like I said, it's just a real damn shame what happened over there. We talked at length about some of his reasons for going on the air and what kinds of stuff they were doing in the community, as well as he describes in depth the raid that took place. They were held at gunpoint for over an hour and a half. Here's a blind man, not armed. He doesn't, as far as I know, he doesn't own any weapons. He is, he's a grandfather. He's a, probably, 45, 50-year-old man. Two kids, a 1 month child. And they were all held at gunpoint for an hour and a half in their home while these thugs, 40 to 50, government agents in full riot gear, like you heard earlier as you were reading that story. It was a multi-jurisdictional task force made up of FCC, U.S. Marshals, state, local, and county police.
Well, that's our own official terrorist force.
Yeah, and they went through his home, ransacked it, stole all of his broadcasting equipment, cut cords, stole computers, stole files, and kicked around some furniture. And here's a man that's just been doing such good work in Illinois. It's just a damn shame.
Is he getting any local support from the media or from the African American community there?
We didn't talk too much about that. We do have a phone number here for him, I believe. And it, if people want to contact him, it's area code 217-789-0038. Gosh, he told me his address and I didn't write it down. It's on tape, though. I can.
Let me run that. Let me get that again.
The number there?
Yeah, it's 217-789-0038. You can email him, through Michael Townsend at. Can I give that email
sure,
address?
Yeah.
mtown1, or there's no space, just mtown1.
mtown1.
At UIS.
The number one.
Number one at uis.edu. Again, if these numbers pass you by the first time because you're not near a pencil, give a call to 423-HUFF, and either I will answer you later or my producer will be able to give you some assistance on that if she's there. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM you're tuned to, where you're listening to the V-Man, probably the most knowledgeable person about free radio in the Santa Cruz County area. And I think I may say that without praising him over much, just a matter of simple fact. And your own Uncle Robert Norse, Bathrop Spears Broadsides is the name of the show at 96.3 FM. We're going to go till 1:30. Did anything come out of the protests, Vinny, that you think people should be aware of in terms of upcoming events to strengthen free radio or kind of adjacent causes?
Well, from my perspective, largely what people in the streets of San Francisco last week were calling for is for the NAB to back off and for NPR, National Public Radio, to back off and allow the LPFM service that the FCC created back in January of this year to go through. LPFM being the rulemaking in order that the FCC issued establishing low-power radio service of 1 to 10 watts or 50 to 100 watts.
Which kind of excludes us.
It excludes us. In fact, the FCC recently issued a reconsideration order on September 20th, coincidentally the same day the NAB festivities got started. And this reconsideration order was basically reaffirming their decision of January 2000 to establish this radio service, but with they caved into some pressure from NPR to allow for more spacing in. There's this radio reading services for the blind that a lot of NPR stations carry, and NPR's concern is that if too many of the of these low power stations go online on the air, then they will interfere with these radio reading services. And so they came out with a whole new class, if you will, of format to have stations like NPR file complaints about any type of possible interference. And if any complaints are lodged, those new LPFM stations will be shut down in order to make room for these radio reading services.
You mean just a simple complaint will have that effect, or they have to find it's verified?
Basically, yeah. I mean, if they make the complaint, they'll investigate it and most likely just shut the station down.
NPR and Shell Oil Rule, I guess.
Yeah, National Petroleum Radio. Mm-hmm. And also in the reconsideration order, they again reaffirmed their decision that unlicensed stations that refuse to go off the air, like the one you're listening to, will still be ineligible for this new service, for these new licenses. So,
because of their wattage, or because they had previously been unlicensed?
Well, because they just have refused to go along with the program and shut down and wait and be good little boys and girls and wait to go on to get a construction permit to build these radio stations that they're trying to push through.
Well, I know San Francisco Liberation Radio, after a stint of being off the air, and I guess the successor to Free Radio Berkeley, after the being enjoined by Claudia Wilkin, the federal judge, who originally gave a very favorable decision on free radio and then kind of turned around and gave an unfavorable decision some years later. They're both back on the air, pretty alive and well. Is free radio alive and well in the Bay Area in other respects? Are there other stations up there as well? Or?
Yeah, it's a vibrant movement here in this part of the world. Like you said, we have San Francisco Liberation Radio operating from 4 to midnight every day. They're also online now at liberationradio.org is their webpage. And like you said, Berkeley Liberation Radio operating 24 hours a day. Now, I don't know though with them, because one of the things I heard up there while I was in San Francisco was that they were being evicted from their current studio on October 1st. So I
could be the day. Huh?
I am not sure if they have come down or not. If they found a new place, they were putting out appeals for money for location to pay rent for a new studio. So.
Is this a censorship type eviction or a financial problem?
You know, I think it's just got something to do with their lease being up, and I think that the landlord is a little scared.
Well, I know Richard Edmondson of San Francisco Liberation Radio, who also sends out a lot of interesting information on the internet, has written a book. Have you seen his new book on micropower?
I've heard about it, though. I know there's a lengthy piece on the history of the National Association of Broadcasters in there. It's, what is it, Class War, The Rise, and something.
What's something like that, yeah.
It sounds interesting. I mean, honestly, I wish I had enough time to write a book. But, you know, we're
busy.
Perhaps
we should all contribute some money to Vinny so he can just dump his job at the, I'm not going to say where you work. You might get fired for that.
No, sticking
little radio transmitters in the bagels. You never can tell what this man's up to. It'd be nice to have you actually write a book. And I think that would be more service. I don't want to criticize your bagel-making activity, but I think somebody else might be able to do that job. But I think very few could do the work of writing a history of free radio in Santa Cruz and, indeed, in other places that you could because of your, dare I say it, encyclopedic knowledge.
Well, I mean, you tend to do that a lot, but there's a lot of other folks in this radio station that have put a lot of hard work and effort in.
Skidmark Bob, of course, doesn't have to be mentioned because he's so vicious. I don't want to talk. You're vicious, Vinny. I don't know. Yeah, I think both of you should write a book on the subject. And of course, instead, you're busy running around trying to pay the rent, right?
That's you know part of it. And also running around trying to get content on the air and always working on keeping, you know, up-to-date information out here. That's what's important to me. I mean, I could write a book, sure, but what's that going to accomplish? I mean, I'd rather spend my time, you know, doing programming and editing tapes and interviewing people like Mbana and others. That's really where it's at for me.
Free Radio used to have a studio in the, what was it called, the Epizone?
The Rhizone?
The Rhizone, right.
Oh, yeah, we had an off-air facility, an office.
I guess that's no longer the case for Free Radio.
Right, well, the Rhizone shut down, unfortunately, and hasn't found a new space. That's the issue a lot of times with the stations. It's like, we've been through that before, where we've had to go off the air because of space considerations, because there's nowhere to be in this town where the rents are so high. And it's a challenge. That's probably what Berkeley Liberation Radio is experiencing right now, and why they're probably off the air.
Well, I know, Vinny, you wanted to talk and run. You had other things to do this morning, so I'm advising people now, if you want to get a word in or a question to Vinny before he hits the road, 427-3772 is the number to call, and call quickly because I can see Vinny is putting on his 7-league boots even as we speak. Wow, what a set of boots they are. And here comes a call.
I have a feeling I know who this is.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
What a couple media whores.
Oh, well, thank
Wake
you.
Wake up, turn on the radio. You guys are babble.
Hey, big boy, why don't you come up and see us sometime?
How's it going, Robert?
It's doing good. It sounds like the infamous Skidmark Bob of legendary status as well.
Oh, yes, of course.
We're hoping to see you and Vinny.
I have an incoming call, but I'm not going to answer it.
Oh, well, that's good. Do you have any comments you wish to make about Vinny's presentation or additions to the, you know, we were talking about the NAB and the new Senate bill to slice off the micropower?
I want to know where Merlin
power.
Free Radio is.
You want to know where
Free Merlin Radio is.
Merlin in exile.
You know why people can't get another station going? I mean, I would you know put the first dollar down.
You know, it surprises me that the Klan or the Aryan Nation or you know some women's group or a church group or some group hasn't gotten together to get another station. What do you make of that, Bob?
Why not a wannabe Rush Limbaugh, whatever?
Yeah, or perhaps Norse 24-hour Norse. Think of it that way.
Go.
Exciting, man. I could keep reading, and I would never go to sleep.
Yeah. But well, it was at a location that you used to live at one point.
That's true. We were able
you
to...
You yourself took care of the FCC and sent them on your way.
Well, I tried to do my best. You know, I'm trying to be friendly to everyone. I invited them out to dinner, but not on the premises. I said, no. They never came back. I guess they didn't like my something.
They were You're a mean guy.
Well, it did provide a few clips of me babbling. I'm not involved here. I have nothing to do with the. I sound a little bit like it was either a Donald Duck or Porky Pig, but I'm not sure.
I think it'd be great to write a book, but you know we just have no time. We're working all the time.
Yeah.
Some of us have kids. I don't know what Edmondson's
Bob, if people want to write a good book on free radio, do you have any recommendations, or you, Vinny, about something that they might look into?
I think someone should make a Nickelodeon type movie about it, like a really good, you know.
Hey.
I don't know, some kind of thing like that, some more real than Hollywood, you know, something along the lines.
Well, there is the Free Radio documentary.
Yeah, I heard there was the Free Radio documentary. Is that available anywhere that people can see it, or?
We do have a copy here in Santa Cruz. We should maybe organize another showing of that.
Yeah,
folks.
We should.
It actually, Mbana is featured in about a 20-minute segment from that video. It's really quite good. Bob, yourself, you're in there as well.
That's right.
And Dr. Theopolis.
Of course, my...
Reckless from Free Radio Austin.
I don't get in there for some reason. I've been censored out again. Merlin and I are going to do a small protest.
Oh, we did it where you lived. You should have known about it.
Probably, you know, but I was probably off doing something else at the time. You know, maybe protesting the sleeping band.
Or on KSCO or something.
Or on KSCO, one of my favorite sister stations.
Weren't you going to get a show
Yeah, there was
once?
A time there that you were making some noise about Free Radio being ineffective there when we were in the pantry of our kitchen there a couple years back.
Well, when you were hiding in the restroom, I always thought, that's interesting. It keeps getting drowned out every time you flush the... But no, I thought, actually, you guys have been really creative in keeping Free Radio on the air. Yeah. How many places has it been to now in the last... 6 or 7 years?
14?
14.
I think it's 14 now, something like that.
Not to mention on a bike and on a...
Well, those are included, the different places. I mean, there was a time we were broadcasting from bike, as you just mentioned, and we broadcast from several different locations as we were mobile, from a truck, from a bike car, from a tricycle. We were even in the downtown parade a couple years ago, the Christmas parade.
Yep.
Wow, that's coming up again this year.
What's her name,
Cynthia Matthews was there,
Matthews.
I think.
She was the one person who voted against free radio.
That's
is that
right?
Yeah,
that's
a matter of fact.
City council. You've actually received city council sanction approval, right?
Yes, we have.
As well as other community programs. I can't think. I haven't even started the coffee yet. I just woke up and heard you guys.
Go get some coffee.
Get some coffee there.
Okay.
Skidmark Bob. And let us know when your next show is going to be.
Is it live or is it Bob?
It's certainly got to be one of the other.
Coffee here, and then I'll have to call you back.
Okay, well, I think
I actually think it's
have
Tuesday
a...
Tuesday or something.
Yeah, I'll look on this. Making Contact.
Tuesdays at, 1:30?
Yeah, 10 o'clock, maintenance show with Skidmore
and
Bob.
Oh, yeah, that's why I wanted to call, because we're playing Democracy Now! On Free Radio Santa Cruz, which is a really good program. Another good use for free radio is that a lot of people cannot receive KPFA to hear, like, Democracy Now! Maybe Flashpoints, those really, really good inspirational programs that... actually have the money to put on really, really good inspirational programs. I mean, we do it too. We don't have the money to be able to do what they do. Like,
but you broadcast Making Contact and other programs regularly that you can't hear on other stations.
Yeah.
Is KPFA, any quick update on them? Are they still pretty much sagging under corporate vampirism, or what's going on up there?
I don't know. Vinny, you know more about that?
KPFA itself seems to be moving along, but the Pacifica National Board recently... had a secret meeting, from what I understand. Dennis Bernstein actually did a piece on this on Friday.
Meeting?
Yeah, they had this meeting where they're trying to put in these local advisory boards in each of the cities where there's a Pacifica station, like in Washington, D.C., New York, and Houston, and I think L.A. is the other one.
Okay, I gotta go get my coffee. I'll
hey,
be listening.
Thanks
bye.
For calling in, Bob.
And from what I understand, these local advisory boards are they're trying to put, you know, a bunch of puppets on there that are, I don't know, I don't really follow the KPFA situation that much, but it seems pretty devious what's going on with these, you know, with this recent meeting they had. Anyhow.
Turn up my mic there. Vinny, is there anything you wish to add before we move on to the next segment of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides?
I just wanted to again put out there that... Human Rights Radio was raided, in case you're just tuning in, and we've been discussing that and other issues around free radio.
That's in Illinois.
Yes. Mabana Kentaco, who was who I consider to be, and others to be, the founder of the micro radio movement, has been on the air almost 13 years now, and he needs to be supported. All of his equipment was stolen, and people want to get in touch with him and find out how you can help him out. Send him a cash donation or a transmitter.
Get a pencil now, folks.
Yeah, grab a pen and paper. 217-789-0038 is the telephone number, and I'm going to be playing a lengthy interview that was conducted yesterday with Mabana on Wednesday night on my show at 9 p.m., Rockin' the Boat, and we'll have address information on that program. I don't have it currently in front of me, but he's in Springfield. So thank you for having me on, Robert, I guess I'll end with fuck the FCC.
It's that old familiar phrase that you don't hear on most other mainstream stations, unless, of course, someone is about to resign or is blowing up completely. Thank you, Vinny. Appreciate your being here, and do tune in, because Vinny, as I said, gives, other than, well, when Skidmark Bob perhaps gives him a run for his money, but We should have a contest at some point to see who can put out more information more quickly about
it. In fact, one other quick thing I wanted to add is that Kind Radio in San Marcos, Texas, recently had to shut down due to a court order in early September. And they went to court on, I believe, on Friday as well. It's a busy day on Friday. And I am also going to be interviewing Joe Patak to find out what happened in court. I haven't even spoke to him yet, but I've contacted him, and I'll be doing a follow-up on that story. So for the latest on Kind Radio and the latest with Mbana, tune in on Wednesdays, if I can plug my own show. It's Rockin' the Boat, Wednesday evenings, 9 p.m.
Definitely, and I'm hoping that I will be tuning in. And if you remember to give 423-HUFF a call, which is both my home phone number and any off-air people who want to get in touch with this show when we're not on, give me a call, Vinny, and maybe I can remember actually to listen to your show this time.
All right, thanks.
Thanks a lot. So, you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Stay with us.
I should like to expound briefly on a theory I have held for some time, to the effect that the reason most folk songs are so atrocious is that they were written by the people. And if professional songwriters had written them instead, things might have turned out considerably differently. For example, consider the old favorite Clementine, you know. In a cavern, in a canyon, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. A song with no recognizable merit whatsoever. And imagine what might have happened if, for example, Cole Porter had tried writing this song. The first verse might have come out like this. In a cavern, in a canyon, excavating for a mine, far away from the boom, boom, boom of the city. She was so pretty, what a pity, Clementine. Oh, Clementine, can't you tell from the howls of me, this love of mine calls to you from the bowels of me. Are you discerning the returning of this churning, burning, yearning for you? Well, supposing at this point that Mozart, or one of that crowd, had tried writing a verse, the next one might have come out as a baritone aria from an Italian opera, somewhat along these lines.
Leggera e come un fairy e sue shoes numero nine herring boxes senza tops sandale per Clementina sì per Clementina sì per Clementina sandale per Clementina sandale per Clementina 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 herring boxes senza tops sandale per Clementina herring boxes senza tops sandale per Clementina, che sciagura Clementina, che sciagura Clementina, cara Clementina, cara Clementina, na 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 na.
Well, supposing now at this rather dramatic juncture in the narrative that one of our modern cool school of composers had tried writing a verse, the next one might have come out like this.
Ducklings to the water, yep, rock, doo-doo-doo-doo, ah-ah, every morning like 9 a.m., oop-pop, doo-doo-doo-doo-doo, bee-bee-ah, got a hung up on a splinter, got a hung up on a splinter, clug him up, fell into the foamy brine, dig that crazy Clementine, man!
And to end on a happy note, one can always count on Gilbert and Sullivan for a rousing finale full of words and music and signifying nothing.
That I missed
Walter depressed her young sister named Esther. This mister to pester she'd try. Now a pestering sister's a festering blister. You'd best resist her, say I. The mister resisted, the sister persisted. I kissed her, all loyalty slipped. When she said I could have her, her sister's cadaver must surely have turned in its crypt. Yes, 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 yes. But I love she and she loves me. Enraptured are the both of we. Yes, I love she and she loves I. And will through all eternity. See what I mean?
That, of course, was Tom Lehrer from his CD, which contains most of his stuff. He's a UCSC math professor or a visiting lecturer, or I'm not quite sure, but he is seen around here occasionally, and as I said, a wonderful songwriter. We'll be hearing some more of him. I'm going to read a very encouraging story that came out of Portland on Thursday, September 28th. Homeless camping ban voided. And that really kind of sums it up. A judge declared Portland's law unconstitutional, calling it cruel and unusual punishment and a violation of the right to travel. Now, I don't have a copy of the Portland law. I'm actually hoping to get one, as well as a complete version of the court decision. And it was not a federal decision. It was a Multnomah County Circuit Court decision, so it was a local decision. But like the decision some months ago in Austin, Texas, like the federal court action in Miami, Florida, like actions in Atlanta and other cities, I'm thinking, well, actually it was more legislative action in Santa Barbara and Eugene, whenever we see people moving in the right direction to decriminalize homeless people outside, it's cause for rejoicing that somewhere, somehow, sanity is triumphing, at least in small places, and at least in a few places in this country. Here's the story. A Multnomah County Circuit Court judge declared Portland's anti-camping ordinance unconstitutional Wednesday, saying it punishes the status of being homeless. Judge Stephen L. Gallagher, Jr. determined that the city's 19-year-old anti-camping law constitutes cruel and unusual punishment and violates a homeless person's fundamental right to travel. There are a great number of alternatives regarding housing, job training, mental health services that should be put into place before our city resorts to arresting individuals for sleeping and eating in the only locations available to them, Gallagher wrote. Wednesday's ruling grew out of an anti-camping citation issued to a homeless man and his son February 10th. Their lawyer argued that the ordinance was unconstitutional under state and federal law and that the ticket should be dismissed. The city in 1981 adopted the ordinance, that's the city of Portland, that permits police to evict people from outdoor campsites where they sleep and store belongings. The city has successfully defended the ordinance in other court challenges, but Gallagher was the first judge to rule on the ordinance's constitutionality when he found that it criminalizes homelessness. Performing such life-sustaining acts as sleeping with bedding is necessary action for someone without a home, Gallagher wrote. This act of sleeping is not conduct that can be separated from the fact of the individual's status of being homeless. Gallagher also said the ordinance unfairly distinguishes between homeless people who have a place to keep their possessions, such as a vehicle or a lean-to, and those who carry their bedding with them and choose a different spot to sleep every night. Those who carry their belongings on their backs, Gallagher said, can't be found in a violation of the ordinance because it requires the homeless to, quote, exhibit a purpose of maintaining a temporary place to live. Interestingly enough, this was the kind of dividing line that the Santa Barbara City Council in 1986, after massive pressure from homeless activists and Mitch Snyder, the Creative Community for Nonviolence National Homeless Organizer, was threatening to bring thousands of homeless people to town to protest. This was the kind of distinction that the Santa Barbara City Council made, which is that you can sleep, but you can't camp. This is also the distinction that was made by David Silva in his two initiatives that got thousands of registered voters to sign up to put on the ballot, though not enough. And this is the distinction the city council refused to make, instead working on some, you know, locally, or some kind of harebrained notion of very, very limited sleeping zones, which went down big time when the police and the local businesses essentially sabotaged them in June. And the city council members who were supposedly supporting them did not speak up for them, the homeless, and did not expose exactly what was being done. So the actual proposal of let people sleep but not camp, that is to say, or in our words, at the homeless working group, which meets every Friday, strike the sleeping ban and the blanket ban sections of the whole camping ordinance, but you can for the moment keep the camping ban. That distinction is one we are continuing to bring up, and we've asked each candidate whether they will support immediate abolition of sections A and B sleeping ban and blanket ban of our camping ordinance. And a bit later, we're going to play some of the responses of the City Council candidates to that. Continuing now with the story from Portland, Oregon, Judge Gallagher said the ordinance also burdens homeless people's equal protection and fundamental right to travel by denying them the opportunity to possess their belongings with them. While traveling throughout the city, they're being denied the basic necessities required for daily living, Gallagher wrote. This infringes on their ability to travel freely. Those who favor the anti-camping ordinance usually say the camps are unsightly and unsanitary and sometimes are havens for people involved in illegal activity. Those who oppose the ordinance argue there isn't enough shelter space for all the homeless in the city, even though officials have made it a priority. Portland Mayor Vera Katz said Wednesday she hopes the city will appeal Gallagher's ruling. I can't see spending millions of dollars to make sure the homeless are housed and at the same time see them camp in our streets, Katz said, referring to the Portland-Multnomah County Shelter Reconfiguration Plan. Our preference is to see the homeless have roofs over their heads, but some say that isn't always possible. Norman D. Hicks, Sr., 56, and Norman D. Wicks, Jr., sorry, not Hicks, but Wicks, that's a father and son, who for the past 5 years have lived in their 1976 Chevy pickup with a camper in the bed, were approached by police after a northeast Portland resident called to complain that their vehicle had been parked on the street on and off for several days. A police officer approached their truck, gave them a ticket, and told them to leave. The elder Wicks receives SSI benefits, and his son earns money running a computer parts recycling business out of the back of their truck, which also holds all their possessions. The pair told the court that they also have trouble getting housing because of the elder Wicks' 7 felony convictions for burglary, theft, and criminal mischief. According to the Wicks' lawyer, Julie Stevens, a staff attorney for Legal Aid Services of Oregon, a nonprofit organization that provides civil legal assistance for low-income people, the father and son couldn't have found shelter care that night, that cold night in February, if they'd tried. We're talking about a 28-degree night in February and a father and son who had nowhere to go but their truck, Stevens said, adding that a homeless advocate testified people in the city limits do, not to mention the 6,000 to 10,000 in the county who are homeless. I would hope the, since the Wickses appeared, let me step back here, we're talking about a 20-degree night in February and a father and son who had nowhere to go but their truck, Stevens said, adding that a homeless advocate testified that all the shelters in Portland were full that night. The judge ruled they were punished because they were homeless and for no other reason. Since the Wicks has appeared before Gallagher in June, they have gotten several other camping tickets, Stevens said. Those cases and those of other homeless people have been held pending Gallagher's decision. I would certainly hope all these tickets would be immediately thrown out, Stevens said Wednesday. Attorneys for the city could not be reached for comment Wednesday, but Stevens said they are expected to appeal the ruling. During the Wicks' case, the city argued that homelessness is not a status, but a condition that comes from voluntary act. Gallagher, however, disagreed that homelessness must be defined either as a status or a condition. That appears to be a matter of semantics, Gallagher wrote. Rather, the court must determine if it is the status or the conduct that is being punished. The Wickses still live in their trucks, Stevens said, but a homeless advocate who testified at their trial recently found them a home. They are expected to move in next month, Stevens said. That's from the Thursday, September 28th, Portland, Oregon, Oregonian. Judge declares Portland's camping ban unconstitutional. And the next day, there was another story in the Portland Oregonian. Even as the city celebrates a triumph in its efforts to address homelessness, it is struggling with an apparent defeat. Mayor Vera Katz joined city and Multnomah County officials and others Thursday morning in a grand opening ceremony for Ritzdorf Court, a 90-unit apartment complex in southeast Portland for people who were homeless and who earned less than 40% of the median income for the Portland area. Less than 24 hours earlier, the mayor and other officials learned that a circuit court judge had declared unconstitutional the city's 19-year-old anti-camping ordinance, which primarily targets the homeless. Now city officials are pondering alternatives and waiting to see if the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office will appeal the decision. The timing of the Ritzdorf opening and the court decision was not lost on City Commissioner Eric Sten, who oversees housing matters in the Bureau of Housing and Community Development, through which funds have been provided for city homeless initiatives. It is interesting that the Ritzdorf opened and the law was thrown out the same week, Sten said, because the law is a reaction to a problem and the Ritzdorf is a solution to the problem, but it's an expensive solution. Certainly, the contrasting turn of events shows two things. Chuck Curry and other advocates for the homeless say how far the city and county have come, yet how far both governments have to go toward improving the homeless situation. As such, Curry hopes this week's attention to the matter could spark interest in developing another plan that would move beyond the groundbreaking Portland-Multnomah County Shelter Reconfiguration Plan, which resulted in 4 shelters and the Ritzdorf. At this point, you've seen no real energy towards moving past this plan, Curry said, and part of that's natural. We've just completed it this week. But they've got to take, and Eric Sten has got to be the one to do this, some real leadership now, particularly with this court decision, which is going to force a new set of circumstances in the city about how we treat people who are homeless. Katz, the mayor, said she is open to that option. The demographics have changed, situations have changed. She said, I always think it's healthy to review to see whether we need to amend it, rethink it to see if we feel comfortable about that we've done what we've made a commitment to do. Or, as I might add, blah, 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 blah. The circuit court decision by Judge Stephen L. Gallagher, Jr., nullifying the anti-camping ordinance, centered on a citation issued February 10th to Norman DeWicks, Sr. and his son, Norman DeWicks, Jr., who was cited for sleeping in their pickup camper. The ordinance adopted in 1981 prohibits camps and other outdoor sleeping areas where people sleep and reside with their belongings. It allows sweeps of the camps and eviction of people at police discretion. It has survived several legal challenges by advocates for the homeless. The Ritzdorf, in some respects, is the crown jewel of the ambitious 8-year Portland Multnomah County Shelter Reconfiguration Plan, which changed the approach by the city and county toward providing residential assistance to single people who are homeless. Built and managed by Reach Community Development Corporation, the Ritzdorf is the final piece and only permanent housing in the plan. The plan involves 4 shelters with just more than 300 beds for single men and women and mentally ill men and women. The permanent housing that the Ritzdorf provides represents the final stage in ending the cycle of homelessness. For Rob Justice, executive director of Buckman Neighborhood Housing Based Join, a center for involvement, more Ritzdorfs might mean less camping. He and other advocates for people who are homeless have been saying for years that the lack of affordable housing, among other factors, significantly contributes to the inability of many to escape homelessness. There is a shortage of housing, Justice said. I think that has been the real emphasis by almost all advocates to try and create more housing, and the new facility that Reach has opened just down the street is a great example. We've already moved in several of our folks into that building. As for the status of the anti-camping ordinance, the district attorney's office will decide whether to appeal the decision because it's a criminal case. As such, Katz is uncertain whether the ordinance remains unenforceable during the time before a possible appeal. This morning it was basically in limbo, the mayor said, though we still have the trespassing ordinance and a park exclusion ordinance. However, Katz said the city remains steadfast in its support of the ordinance. I would rather spend my energy and my resources to make sure that people have a roof over their heads than to allow camping grounds that potentially could be unsafe and unsanitary, she said. And that's from the Portland Oregonian. Ruling may force look at homeless policy about Judge Gallagher's decision on Wednesday overturning Portland's camping ban, which also includes a sleeping ban, as well as a ban on having your possessions, sort of a possession ban. Or a backpack ban, I'm not sure what we call it. Of course, missing from both these articles is the key stat. How many homeless people are there in Portland, Oregon, and how many shelter spaces are there for homeless people? Or, if you will, even permanent housing options. And the answer, of course, isn't in the article because we would all be blasted away, just as in Santa Cruz, there is space tonight for less than 3% of the city's homeless people and probably less than that percentage of the county's. There's only 28 bed spaces in Santa Cruz, bed spaces, floor spaces with sleeping bags and mats, or blankets and mats, there aren't bed spaces, for 28 people on the floor of churches in terms of open emergency shelter, and it isn't open, of course, because it's all taken up. And that's supposed to deal with 1,000 to 2,000 people outside. It's preposterous. And, of course, if it were brought into the paper as a clear figure, it would be even more glaring. That's why you don't see those figures clearly a lot in Heather Berner's stories or Daryl Cole's stories or Ken McLaughlin's San Jose Mercury News stories about the Santa Cruz situation, because it would be sort of blowing the whistle on things to bring those figures up in a clear way. That's why the city council doesn't bring up those figures. That's why you don't see the Board of Supervisors bringing up those figures. That's why it's up to us to bring up those figures. Phone lines are open. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3 FM. I'm your host, Bathrop's Pierre Robert Norse, and we're going to be going now till 1:30, so tune in. Also, for those of you who are tuned in hopes of hearing some commentary on the NAACP League of Women Voters Forum, the City Council Candidate Forum, we are going to be talking about that. The actual tape, I'm afraid, it's audible if you listen very carefully, but it's not really air broadcast worthy. So I can't really do that, and I'm going to hope that at some point I can get some community members who are at that forum to discuss how utterly inadequate it was. Or perhaps they have different views. That was my view, and that seemed to be the view of Kaya Hunt. who you heard on the air last Thursday and who was going to be on the air today, but unfortunately she has got a job she has to get to and she cannot come on the air. But she's hoping, we were hoping that she could, and she was hoping that she could line up some folks to call in. So perhaps if any of you are listening now and want to give your opinions as to whether any of these council candidates sounded like they were worth a shit, if you'll forgive me for putting it that way, give a call to 427-3772. 427-3772. That's free radio, and you are tuned to 96.3 FM. And we will take that. The official view of the Oregonian, of course, came out this Sunday about this anti-camping law decision, the law that threw out the camping ban, and it's your standard sentinel, know-nothing, NIMBY rhetoric. It's a form of bigotry, and let's hear it. I mean, it's instructive to hear it because it sounds like a sentinel editorial. It reads like this. Multnomah County Circuit Judge Stephen L. Gallagher Jr. last week found Portland's 19-year-old anti-camping law cruel and unusual and a violation of a homeless person's fundamental right to travel. He's flat wrong in both instances, and the district attorney should quickly appeal his decision to higher courts. There's nothing cruel and unusual about moving people off streets and into safer, more sanitary shelter. Of course, this is a very misleading statement, constantly used by council members locally, like Rotkin, and used by city council candidates, like Emily Riley, who somehow seem to indicate that there's going to be shelter for people, when there is no possibility whatsoever of there being any kind of shelter to cover the entire homeless population in the near future, without spending millions and millions and millions of dollars, which they are not advocating doing. So it's a complete dodge, and it is the lowest kind of shell game. You keep a person's eye on one argument while you shift the pea. You say, well, we want to give them shelter. We don't want to give them these grubby accommodations outside. That would be no fair and no fun. And they haven't got shelter. Well, they can't be there. It's illegal to be there. So we'll just have to wait until they get shelter. In the meantime, move along. Or as I describe Mike Rotkin's policy, and it would be, I guess, Scott Kennedy's policy now, as he's running again for city council, hide out or get out. Continuing with this nasty editorial from the Portland Oregonian, nor is it a punishment to offer services such as medical and mental health treatment, counseling, and employment advice. No, the punishment is to arrest people for sleeping. That's the punishment, Oregonian. Getting back to the story, I'm sorry, I'm getting a little exercised here as I read this. Continuing with the story, that's not cruel and unusual, it's appropriate, it's necessary, and it's humane. And while the ability to move from place to place at will is a fundamental American freedom, even a cursory look at the case upon which Gallagher ruled suggests that traveling wasn't the issue here, camping was. People can travel on public streets and thoroughfares, they just can't make their homes on them. Poverty does impose an obligation on the community at large to care for the poor and provide them with at least the necessities of life, but it does not confer upon the individual the right to live anywhere or do anything as a consequence of being poor. A person doesn't have the right to sleep, eat, camp, or do anything else on public space not designed to accommodate such activity safely and healthfully. Mayor Vera Katz responded to the judge's ruling, "I can't see spending millions of dollars to make sure the homeless are housed and at the same time see them camp on our streets." She was referring to the Portland Multnomah County Shelter Reconfiguration Plan, which resulted in four shelters and some more permanent housing. "I would rather see my energy and my resources to make sure, or spend that energy and resources to make sure that people have a roof over their heads rather than to allow camping grounds that potentially could be unsafe and unsanitary." She is exactly right. Some folks refuse to accept public shelter and assistance, and some advocates for the homeless insist the city and county have yet to provide even enough basic shelter for people in need. Even if those advocates are correct, the answer is not to assert a non-existent right to camp on the public streets. Condoning and promoting camping on the streets and parks and under bridges is a far more cruel and unusual approach than offering shelter and perhaps even the opportunity to get off the streets permanently. That's a Saturday editorial, which was published on Sunday in the Portland Oregonian. Of course, missing from this editorial is any timetable, any description of the expense involved, or of the actual, whether there's actually any political will to do this. It's all. Get those folks out of here, please. We don't want them camping on our streets. And we're very familiar with this here in Santa Cruz because we saw that whole NIMBY mentality as personified by Catherine Byers on the city council, actually probably more personified by Cynthia Matthews, but Byers was a swing vote, the woman we depended upon to reestablish civil rights for homeless people, at least in some limited way, in terms of safe sleeping areas, and she failed miserably. And that's without essentially succumbing to police pressure and the pressure of some select businesses. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, and As I promised, I'm now going to play you a little something from the Homeless Working Group. Here's a person you haven't heard from much, and you're probably going to hear from him more if you go to the City Council candidate forums, though I think a lot of the forums are up. I mean, they've already happened. I guess the next one that I know of is October 13th at the Chamber of Commerce, which is a couple of weeks down the road. This is Mark Premack, who is an architect. He was on the Planning Commission for a while. He definitely favors the sleeping ban, or he doesn't favor amending it. He doesn't favor even changing the blanket ban, the law in Santa Cruz that makes it illegal to cover up with a blanket after 11 o'clock at night and prescribes a $54 fine if you're caught with a blanket awake or asleep after 11 o'clock. Here he is talking to the Homeless Working Group, which is our sort of little group of advocates which meets every Friday at 3 o'clock at the Holiday Inn Chamber of Commerce headquarters. We'll be meeting next Friday. Invite you to come down. Here he is talking and sort of answering some questions which I'm putting to him. Also in the room were candidates Ed Porter and Jacob Olthoff, and you get to hear kind of a combination of these folks talking.
We have Bernard and Becky, but I just want to remind folks that we have only about 25 minutes left, and we have some questions I'd like to get some quick answers from the candidates for. Admittedly, this is also an educational session. I'm glad that people are asking questions. Bernard, if you want to jump in, you can. I encourage people to, again, ask questions of the candidates and maybe get some quick answers.
I
don't know is a legitimate answer. I want to remind candidates.
Mark, I'm trying to ask you this without being confrontational, but it's hard. your reason for not wanting to repeal, you know, the Section A and B of the sleeping ban is because you want to look for more private, you know, type of solutions. And here we are, we're talking about, you know, possibly extending the property owner's right to allow homeless people to live in driveways more than 3 days, and I wasn't clear on what your position on that is.
Well, I've been on the zoning board for years. I'm not on now. I read the ordinances all the time in terms of zoning ordinances, and I like to think that I know much about the zoning ordinances, but this camping permitted section is not something I've ever seen. And so the question is, how many citizens are aware of it? We're talking about changing a law. Great, it's on the books. How many people are aware of it? As an architect, people call me all the time and say, I want to know what I can do. Can I add a second bedroom? Can I convert my garage? Can I add a granny unit? People don't know. I mean, the law is not... It's not like the Gideon's Bible. It's not in everybody's bedside.
So Mark's answer, in a word, was we should simply publicize the existing law more thoroughly and let people know what their rights are, and that would kind of solve the problem. For those who don't know, there is a little exemption to the sleeping ban sections of the camping ordinance, and I guess in a vehicle anyway, that says if you get the permission, written permission of the owner of the property and the renter, you can park in their driveway in a vehicle and sleep in that vehicle 3 nights a month, period. That's it. And Mark kind of, it was asked of Mark, would he be interested in making it a longer period of time you could sleep? In essence, he said no. No, he's not interested in that. His argument was generally that if it hadn't been for all these activists agitating loudly on this issue, people would have been willing to help homeless people more and wouldn't be in the shape we're in. I kind of brought up to him, asked him if he believed that in the South, if those uppity niggers had not been so uppity, that there wouldn't have been the kinds of civil rights problems there were, and that the generous Southern whites would have granted them their rights. He had no answer to that particular question. But I thought his answer was equally foolish and false. It's a sort of a conservative dodge. You can hear a little more of him talking about this now.
It's purely symbolic. Nobody's aware of it. Nobody's enforcing it. If you want to see it go away, if you want to see a prohibition on anybody sleeping in a driveway, if that's your goal, is to escalate the problem, then I say bring it up now.
So in other words, don't bring it up.
Say yeah, don't bring it up.
So keep it as
it is. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. first off, about the camping permitted section, there are no campgrounds in the city of Santa Cruz. The last one was closed in spring of 98, I think it was. Bob's Pine Grove Campground was closed by the city. Also, you'll notice in this section where it says permit for camping in city park, it says under authority for more than 3 nights in any 12 months. If you were going to use this camping permitted section to actually provide places for homeless people to go, you would have to change that to make it legal for the city or a nonprofit organization to set up some kind of campground. When you were talking about River Street Shelter, which has 32 beds, you also mentioned Community House, Page Smith Community House, which cost about $2.3 million to build. It houses 40 people. That's, I was on the board of directors, Citizens Committee for the Homeless, and that was the construction cost, you know. I did see an earlier design. Was that yours?
Yes.
Yeah, it was kind of a triangle thing.
No,
I think it was kind of.
Page Smith did. We had him as a model. I don't want to take a lot of time. Mm-hmm. We had as a model farm worker house, which you see up the side. It was light construction, light construction. There were bathing facilities that there people had private rooms, but there and the private rooms had. A toilet and a sink in the room, and,
Mark Premix began.
And people went down the hall or this kind of porch way to get to shower facilities, and we were trying to create a prototype that could work anywhere in the country that would be inexpensive to build, and it was right after the earthquake. We went after people advised us to go after state money. The state, the various agencies said, we don't have a category for funding this. We need to do this as SROs. Well, what does that mean? That means individual bathrooms for each, accessible bathrooms for each unit. So suddenly the cost went up 60% to create this. And then, of course, we didn't get the funding. And by the time we were done, it was portables that went.
Went from donated trailers to.
Yeah, to donated trailers to. It's just, I'm sorry, I kind of lost fire over that one.
Yeah, we thought that $2.3 million to build was just, an unbelievable cost for the kind of facility that we got, which is, it's very nice right now, the people there that are housed.
I know, and I don't complain publicly about it. I mean, maybe this is public, but it was very disheartening to, it was very disheartening to try to create a prototype for, homeless people, create inexpensive shelter for homeless people.
Mm-hmm.
In Texas, in Houston, they have there's an underground group that goes up and puts up a shelter on disused land, and they can get it up in 4 hours. It's just they go in by in cover of night. There's another shelter for a homeless person in Houston, and they've put up hundreds of these.
And how many of those are you going to
build? Donated
labor. And the Japanese use these shelf.
Yeah. So it's. But that's direct action. That's people doing positive things, and it's very difficult for government. And this is what Paige Smith and Paul Lee learned when they started the emergency shelter on Cedar Street. They didn't ask government. They didn't go through an EIR process to do that. They had a willing property owner who let them go in. They did it. The progressive politicians were up in arms about it. I'm sure you've all read Equality and Mercy.
And while a lot of this history is accurate, although The Quality of Mercy is a horrible book by Paul Lee, he skips the contributions of lots of activists, trashes me and others, and gives himself mountains of credit for homeless rights activity. It's interesting that Mark Premack, in public forums, likes to take a lot of credit for being involved with Community House and Page Smith Community House, but here in private or in the relative seclusion of a homeless working group, acknowledges it's vastly overpriced, and you don't get to hear him say that in a public forum. And he talks about direct action, but obviously a significant direct action might be to eliminate the camping ban, or at least the sleeping ban and blanket ban sections, until there really is adequate shelter, and to set up some more reasonable camping regulation ordinance. You don't see him doing that because he is dependent, and perhaps he's simply of the same mindset of wealthy West Side people. I should say, well-to-do West Side people. Like, it's hard for me to think of a poor architect. Maybe he's poorer than I thought. I haven't seen his financial statement. So he's interesting to listen to, and he's got some new things to say in terms of rounding out our picture of some of the history of this, you've got to be very careful taking his arguments at face value. Let's listen a little further to Mark Premack and the other two city council candidates, Ed Porter and Jake Olthoff, at the Homeless Working Group.
Reminiscence on that. Took direct action, a positive action, to do something good, and it was very difficult for the politicians to shut it down.
If candidates want to do direct action, I would be much in favor of helping them. Anybody wants to propose direct action between now and the election, I'll be there. So.
I'm sorry I'm taking so long getting through this. The ISSP program, which is our major temporary shelter for homeless people, emergency shelter, has 28 floor spaces for 8 months of the year, and in the winter, 156. You can see that just takes care of a little portion. My question, I have a question here. We have a lot of tourist business in Santa Cruz. We have lots of motel space that is primarily used in the summer months. We have a greater need in winter for shelter for homeless people. Would you advocate setting up some sort of arrangement with business owners of motel space so that you could rent those unused motel rooms in winter in blocks for a reduced price so that homeless people could be temporarily housed on an emergency basis in the winter? That's my question.
I hadn't thought about that before this moment. I would, if the university can do it, I don't know why the city can't do it for homeless people. I think you would want to look at the money that we have available for such programs.
This is Ed Porter speaking.
The smartest use of it, as opposed to buying something that is going to be used in perpetuity. I don't know the answer to that. It's kind of tantalizing to say, yes, let's go rent some places right now and put some people up right now, but in the bigger view of things, that might not be the smartest way to spend the money. I don't know. I'm willing to get educated about that, but that's not a program that I've considered or looked at before.
Well, that was one of the things the hotel people wanted out of this 2% increase in the transient occupancy tax. They wanted to sit at lift from the city. They would rent some of their rooms during the winter for homeless people with this money that they were going to be getting from.
They were asking for
it. Yeah.
Well, if the hotel people want to do it, that takes away one of the things.
So, quickly, any quick answers from you, Mark, and you, Jake, and then David here is again, bumped off the list right now.
I think hotels have been used in the past by various agencies to house people in need. I'm reasonably sure of that off-season. And so the question is, should that be something that can be looked at as a way of housing homeless people in the winter? And as Ed said, you get X number of dollars, you look and see where it's most effective.
And of course, it's always struck me that paying the Patels and the other profiteers at these hotels for their rooms at the to the tune of $20 or $30 a night is ridiculous when you can house dozens of people in a campground for a fraction of the cost, and you're left in a situation where you house a few people and the rest of the people face brutality, they face discrimination, they face criminalization by the police and all that entails. So it is, it's never seemed to me to be a useful idea, even though at the last meeting of the Homeless Working Group, and you're listening to the Friday before last, but last Friday, several days ago, day before yesterday, Michael Schmidt brought up that since Jan Butte's supervisor is not interested in opening up the Emmeline parking lot at night because, she's afraid the neighbors will get all upset, and why aren't the homeless people asking for it in greater numbers at the Board of Supervisors if they really want it, and how come you're involved with all these radical, crazy people? This was her response to Michael Schmidt, the area Chamber of Commerce's, who's also now working with the Homeless Working Group, and his letters and his appeals to Supervisor Jan Butte to, hey, there's space at the Emmeline Street parking lot each night. There's restroom and shower facilities nearby. People could be in and out. How can you possibly ignore this important resource and this pressing need? And of course, she's been ignoring it for years and has no problem ignoring it for the next decade, as do as have Marty Wormhout and Jeff Almquist and the other supervisors. They have no problem in ignoring it either. So we've been listening to the Homeless Working Group with Ed Porter, and I just got a call from Kaya Hunt. For those of you who are interested in the situation for black people in Santa Cruz, she's an African-American individual. She was at the forum and rather disgusted with it and outspoken in her anger at what happened at that NAACP so-called candidate forum, where not one question from the floor got asked. Instead, they had these sort of planted questions from establishment media journalists. Ironically, those questions in a way mirrored some of the ones I was proposing but was not allowed to ask, and they were not as, I think, sharply put or as specific to the issues, but they talked about one question was from Bill Honig, he's the editor of the Santa Cruz County Urinal, or Sentinel, as they like to call themselves, asking about how far can government go in actually helping the homeless. Another question was from a KZSC reporter, actually the only question asked by an African-American black reporter, about the police, what we do about the police abuse. And there were several other questions, one about housing in the beach flats and affordable housing projects. And I actually would have put it somewhat differently, but those are three areas, and we got the usual waffling, paper shuffling, self-congratulatory comments, and very few substantial answers. And I exempt Steve Argue from that. And I would have exempted Jake Fathy in the past on the sleeping ban issue, but now he has shifted back to this largely meaningless find safe sleeping zones proposal. Because people who talk about finding safe sleeping zones without proposing exactly where they're going to go and saying they'll fight for them are talking about endlessly delaying. That's my take on that so-called safe sleeping zone stuff. Unless they say, this is where I want the safe sleeping zone to be, and this is how it's going to be, like David Silva did, and we did when we worked with him in the two initiatives, which set out large areas of the city that would, in essence, be safe sleeping zones, not safe in terms of comfortable and sanitary and well-policed, but safe in terms of safe from tickets. Unless the candidates do that, they are simply evading the issue and mouthing comfortable rhetoric, because what's needed is to strike the sleeping ban and the blanket ban immediately as a human rights violation, and then to say, you'll enforce other laws, blocking the sidewalk, pee-peeing in the park, disturbing the peace, vandalism, things of that sort. But sleeping itself is preposterous as a way, as something that you criminalize all over the city. And, of course, there's only one person who's coming out for that in any clear public way, Steve Argue. Bonnie Moore talks about we can't make sleeping a crime, but when I keep telling her, then say strike sections A and B, she babbles on about safe sleeping zones and just withdraws. She seems to lose her tongue. Similarly with Scott Bugenthal, while he talks about sleeping should not be a crime and was very forthright before the Homeless Working Group, when it came to the larger forums, he was, again, talking about safe sleeping zones. So you can always cross your fingers and hope that later on, and this is what Ed Porter is sort of implies, once you get us in power, we'll find some good things to do, like fire the city manager. He hasn't said he'll do that, but, you know, it's something he can't talk about, you see, in public beforehand, because that would... you wouldn't get elected if you said that sort of thing. That's the sort of the Marty Wormhout conventional wisdom scan insider line. And I got to tell you, that's an anti-democratic line. You say what you're going to do. You put it up for the community. If you don't get elected, you still fight for that through organizing in the community. And even the people who don't agree with you on city council may be forced to do it when you persuade the community you're right and they come in sufficient numbers to city council. So we got some interesting comments from Ed Porter, but the most interesting thing is what happened at a Emily Riley kickoff rally that happened up at 660 Escalona, which is sort of a fancy West Side house. You had to hike up a driveway up a hill. There was a very sweet woman who was hosting it at her house. I don't remember her name. She was very nice. And Emily Riley made vacuous speeches about what she was and wasn't going to do and how charmed she was and smiled at everybody and so forth. But there was, for my money, very little substance. And I admit, I am somewhat significantly colored by her shift on the sleeping ban. She did not call us up and say, we met with her, attempted to meet with her repeatedly, and finally got a meeting with her, and she hadn't even read the damn sleeping ban, although she had been sitting on committees supposedly considering the safe sleeping zones that were voted in May and then dumped by the city council in June under this police politicking. But she hadn't even read them. You know, hadn't even read the law. And she never got back to us with any meaningful discussion on the subject. She just simply sort of, I ran into her at a Scott Bugenthal kickoff rally, and she promised me, I'm going to support David Silva's initiative, which is to, and I will support putting that into law, which his initiative said, set up essentially one-third of the city as a safe sleeping zone, and the rest, if anyone's sleeping in it, you move them into the other part of the city. But you don't arrest them for sleeping anywhere, you just move them. And she said she'd support that. Well, 2 weeks later, she wasn't going to support that. And she didn't call us up with any explanation, never made her way to the homeless working group. She was repeatedly invited. She was never able to make it. So, as far as I'm concerned, Emily Riley is history. And she's I could be pleasantly surprised by her in office, but frankly, I don't think we want to sit around waiting for surprises. We saw this kind of surprises Keith Sugar gave us, such as arresting Michael Tomasi at the last city council meeting. Tomasi is a man who lives in his van, a homeless person. I think I may have mentioned him at the last council, at the last, on Thursday, when I do this show. Tomasi had called himself a nigger. He had called himself, in essence, a nigger in the sense of an oppressed person who is regarded as worthless and of low value, which is how whites regarded blacks in the main, and still do in much of the country. And when he called himself that word, Sugar told him that he couldn't use that word at the mic, even if he was using it in a legitimate political context, and actually had him escorted from the room for essentially angry political speech. And I digress here. I'm sorry for digressing. We're talking about Ed Porter, and Ed was at this Emily Riley kickoff rally, and activist Bernard Klitzner, who was a member of the homeless working group, had written a letter to the paper in which he used a sentence in which he denounced the city council for not taking action to end the sleeping ban or to put the sleeping ban on the ballot, and suggested that the real culprit here was council member Catherine Byers, and that if a dead homeless person is found, people should carry the body to the yard of Catherine Byers. Well, apparently Ed Porter was so scandalized by that he was saying he would never talk to Bernard Klitzner. Or he wouldn't talk to Bernard Klitzner because of that letter. And I'm going to play you the discussion that ensued when I attempted to get him to answer some questions at this party. And here you get to hear it. It's a little bit hard to hear because of the background noise. Again, this is Emily Riley's kickoff party about 3 weeks ago. And you'll hear some different voices. I'll interrupt briefly to clarify what's going on.
Bernard Klitzner, you guys just had a conversation with Emily Riley because I guess at the scan form, Emily said she paid a living wage to her workers.
Yes, she did. And at that, someone who was sitting in the audience heard one of the workers say, well, I worked for her and I didn't get a living wage. And for that reason, we came up and asked Emily Riley just now what she actually does pay the workers. And it turns out that it's only certain workers after they've worked there for a few years that get what's considered a living wage, around $11 an hour. But workers there start off at $7 an hour, which hardly makes for a claim that she pays her workers a living wage.
Now, it should be said that supporters of Emily Riley, when I later brought this up, said, oh, she didn't say she pays a living wage. She only said she tries to pay a living wage. So that was the response they had to this concern by, and you're listening to candidate Steve Argue, who was also at this kickoff rally for Emily Riley, talking to activist Bernard Klitzner.
I mean, for her to be honest, to have been honest Wednesday night, she would have had to have said she pays some of her workers a living wage.
Did you challenge her on this issue?
Well, we talked about it, and I mean, we got the information. I mean, she's not someone who I'm looking to as someone who's going to do anything for us, and for that reason, I didn't. I don't know. I held my tongue. I didn't say anything more to that, but we got the information on what it actually
is. Well, I expect her to correct those misstatements. If she is falsely claiming she pays her workers a living wage and does not pay her workers a living wage, well, then she should correct her statements.
That's true.
And also, of course, not last but hardly least, the vicious Bernard Klitzner. Bernard, you actually engineered this whole episode. Any comments on what you...
Well, yes, I know that there was a contradiction there. I did not want to confront her, you know, in this environment. I know, you know, that there's personal contradictions in my life. However, I am not running for office. I think that she needs to deal with that. If she's going to tell the people in public that she pays a living wage, I think she needs to, you know, now go back to the bakery and give, making sure that every worker there gets a living wage. You know, and I guess I would accept that right now as $11 an hour, even though I really don't want to.
Thank you, Bernard. Do you want to comment on Emily Riley as a
candidate? Yes, she'll be an excellent council person.
And we are speaking to?
Diane Dubrava. Wife of our candidate, Richard.
The power behind the throne.
Blah, blah. Yeah, Emily's a great
gal.
Don't
you forget it.
And we'll be hearing more from you, Dick, 2 weeks at the Homeless Working Group.
I'll be there. I'll be there.
And it should be said that Dick Dubrava did show up 2 weeks later, which was 2 days ago. He does not support ending the sleeping ban. He has plans about establishing some kind of homeless czar or... As Department of Services that particularly concerns itself with homeless people at the city level, but generally does not support the sleeping ban. He did, however, say that he would support guarantees of continued residency for the tenants of the Dolphin apartment buildings. That's the Beach Flats apartment that City Council is currently going to go into closed session this Tuesday, in a special session of the City Council, not their usual session at 1 o'clock, to consider... buying the property. And Scan and other activists like myself have asked that they not do this until after the election, because they are not, unless they provide guarantees that the people who are currently living there will be able to remain there, because the organization that they are mandating it be turned over to, Mercy Charities Housing, has had a number of hurdles that it requires people to go through, involving income requirements, past felony convictions, whether they've been unlawful detainers, that is to say evictions in their past, credit problems, and then the whole question of whether they would use the, quote, overcrowding as a basis for evicting people from the housing, giving them a little relocation money and sending them on their way, but essentially denying them housing, which they currently have. And SCAN on May 31st voted to say, let's not do this. We ask City Council to make sure that the guarantees will be in place before they engage in any kind of property acquisition. And Catherine Byers and Mayor Keith Sugar, in a blatant violation of his word to activists, which was repeated on tape and played on this station, voted to ignore the guarantees and to proceed with the property acquisition. And they're holding a special council meeting on Tuesday. It's not going to be an open session at all. It's only a closed session, although we can go before the closed session starts and speak, and I encourage people to come 1 o'clock on Tuesday, day after tomorrow, at City Council and talk to support the tenants, or to call in to City Council 420-5017 and say, don't acquire this property unless you get those guarantees first written into law. Dubrava did support the idea. He said he would come back to us to reconfirm, but unless he heard something that he felt would be opposite information, he would support publicly speaking out about the tenant guarantees, requiring tenant guarantees. Of course, by the time he does, the property will probably be transferred, but we'll see what happens with that. You're listening again to a tape, and I'm sorry, we haven't quite got to the Ed Porter section yet, but it's worth waiting for, so stay with us. And also, Kaya Hunt is going to be worth waiting for. She'll be on the air at 1 o'clock. We're going to call her and have her give her opinion of just how Oreo the forum was, or even less than Oreo. I'm not using her words, I'm using mine. She's going to talk at 1 o'clock on Free Radio, and perhaps we'll get some call-ins from other folks who were at that NAACP candidate chat-chat and schmooze and see what they have to say. But right now we're listening to Ed Porter, or actually what happened at the kickoff party for Emily Riley several weeks ago. Stay with us.
That here first.
Yes.
We'll be showing up at your house with our sleeping bags. Otherwise, thank you.
We'll see you, Robert. Take care.
All right. Candidate Riley. Right. Free Radio Santa Cruz.
right up.
Not at this time.
All righty. I'm here as the party kind of winds down around 7:20 in the refreshment room, which has been refreshed with new refreshments. There's still Bruce Bratton, Catherine Byers, Rachel O'Malley, Susan Martinez, Ed Porter, Marty Wormhout, Chris Crone, and Celia Scott. So the notables are still clustering among each other. Marty Wormhout has been moving away from me as I move towards her, which is sort of refreshing to see. And Ed Porter says he will not talk to Bernard Kouchner because of his letter and phone call in St. Louis. So Ed is, after letting Bernard wait for 5 or 10 minutes while he was talking to 3 other people. I remember that fine letter. When a homeless person dies, carry the body to the yard of Catherine Byers. Quite appropriate, considering she voted for keeping the sleeping bear. We're wondering if Ed is going to follow in her footsteps. That's the question.
He said he just said that he didn't respond to his call because of that letter.
Pretty thin-skinned, you know, if you can't deal with that honest political opinion, however hard.
Yeah.
Right. Anyway, so here we are in the canapé room, observing the situation. And Bernard continues to try to get an answer from Ed about coming to the homeless working group. Not sure how long this is going to take. So, Gordon Husser, this is one of your candidates, this Emily Riley person. Tongue-tied in front of the tape recorder here. So surely you're not afraid to say if she's, you support Emily.
Where is this? Of course I support Emily.
Oh, right. It's going to free radio.
Oh, okay. Emily's a good person to work with. And she...